Good morning and hello again. Today, testing problems around the world. We'll hear from the WHO, nursing leader Phil Nihay on keeping health workers here safe. Garda middle managers ask for protection against COVID-19. How the criminal drugs business is adapting to the crisis. Also, we talked to the Justice Minister, Charlie Flanagan, about concerns over people in direct provision as 650 new beds are procured. Niall Moyna and Lindsay Peat on keeping fit when confined to home. Evelyn meets motorbike volunteers who deliver vital medical supplies, jobs under threat as regional newspapers see their advertising revenue collapse, and our regular GP, Dr. Maura Finn, answers your coronavirus queries. Email today, sor@rte.ie, text us on 51551, and you can also tweet at todaysor. 860,000 cases, more than 42,000 deaths. Those are the latest global figures on the COVID-19 coronavirus as of this morning. But this massive pressure on healthcare systems around the world is also creating problems, not least here in Ireland, with our capacity to test for the virus and to protect our frontline workers with personal protective equipment. On the line now, Dr. Margaret Harris, a member of the World Health Organization's coronavirus response team. Good morning to you, Dr. Harris. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Sean. Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, what is the WHO saying about the global shortage of testing equipment?
So this is one of the areas that we've been working very, very hard with many countries to ramp up capacities. Now, there are a bunch of different tests. One of the issues is something called reagent, which is our chemicals needed to process the test to make the test work. And as you know, there's been shut down with industrial areas and all kinds of problems. But we still say we must work to test wherever we can, because if you don't know where the virus is, you can't stop the transmission.
And that is a problem, is it, with reagent? It's certainly evident in this country and it's hampering our capacity to conduct the tests, or at least to get the results of the tests. Is it prevalent in pretty much every other country as well?
Yes, it is a problem all round. And as we get larger and larger and larger outbreaks, of course, these problems continue. So there are other ways, again, understanding your surveillance, understanding your community, understanding the potential signs. Doing the sort of hard disease detective work is important as well. So what I mean by that is, if you know somebody has a case of coronavirus, find out everybody around that person who could potentially have a case, monitor them carefully, assume that they have a case. So that's in order to break the transmission.
Indeed. But just on the point of this chemical reagent, that's the ingredient, is it, that amplifies sections of a person's DNA when the test is being analysed?
That's a good way of explaining it, yes. So what you do a process in the laboratory to look at the DNA. It's not the person's DNA, it's the DNA of the virus, sorry. So it's the actual virus. You're breaking it down, making it amplify in the laboratory, and then you do a reading to see if that is a positive for the virus in the swab that you're analysing.
Now, we in this country, the government here, hoped to be able to conduct something like 15,000 tests per day. We're well off that, and partly it's because of the absence or the lack of the chemical reagent. So presumably that impedes our attempts to flatten the curve.
It is one thing that's going to make it more difficult, but there are other ways. So again, we did say test, 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 because we wanted people to be testing right at the beginning so that they could break the transmission before we got to the stages where people had, where countries had very large outbreaks. So now you have to look at other ways. And one of them is to look clinically or to understand where the virus has moved to. So that's why I'm saying before, work with your people in community, help them to understand what symptoms they need to be looking for, help your surveillance people, get your surveillance teams out there looking for all the cases of the virus, and really work with the people, all the people listening now. How do we protect ourselves? We protected ourselves by the old-fashioned stuff we've been talking about for months now, the rigorous hand washing, the rigorous environmental cleaning, clean all around, not sharing utensils, not sharing towels, not sharing all the different things that will help us to spread the virus between ourselves. And that's why governments have resorted to these big lockdowns, to just simply stop the movements in community.
We've had some good news about this in this country, Dr. Harris. Firstly, the fact that the number of contacts per confirmed case has fallen from 20 per person to now 3 in the last few days. Also, there had been a forecast of 15,000 cases in Ireland by the end of March. The actual number is just over 3,000, 3,200 or so. But I suppose the problem is that maybe people might become a little bit complacent.
So, yes, and that is good news. And you're quite right. The real message here is keep at it. So, you know, once you're getting a handle on things, you need to tighten that handle, tighten that grip, really, really, really slow it down. You will still have some more transmission. It won't be stopped completely immediately, but you need to slow it down as much as possible to give your health workers that breathing room and the people who are very sick that they're looking after a chance to get through it.
And what would you say in particular, say, to healthier people and fit and active people over the age of 70 who have been asked for a fortnight to stay at home, not to leave their homes, not to leave their houses, and to go out to get their normal exercise? How would you encourage them to stick with this?
It's tough. I must say, as somebody who loves a good walk myself, it's very tough. So, but think about maybe learning a new exercise skill, and a skill that you can do inside. There are all those online dance tapes, all those online yoga and other kinds of Pilates and all those things that normally most of us don't have time to do or haven't really had the inclination to do. Now's the time to really explore all the other ways you can be physically fit while having the restrictions on your movement outside.
Now, no matter how well, I suppose, countries battle against this, there is a fear or concern about a second wave. Now, what is the WHO's expectation as to the timing of that and that second wave? And will it be as difficult to deal with as the first wave?
So this sort of concept of the second wave really comes from the world of flu. Now, remember, we're dealing with a completely new virus that's got into our community. And even though, as you know, we've had these discussions and we've been saying this is a serious virus, it is one that has kind of taken many people by surprise. So we can't expect it to behave exactly as the flu. But what is clear is that we're a very, very connected world. So when we begin to relax and when people begin to move more, there is likelihood of importation of infection again. So that's what people are talking about with second wave. It just means that you could reseed the infection in your community if you let your vigilance drop.
Yeah, and I suppose another concern is just about the global south, less developed countries that might not have the testing capacity. How will we even know when the virus is transmitting in some of those places?
So I think you're talking about countries that are resource poor.
Yes, and wealthy countries, I suppose, are buying up all the test kits and the reagent where they can.
Well, no, in fact, many of them had the test kits already because very, very early on in the outbreak, we identified around 40 countries that really had very, very weak health systems and were very resource poor. We also looked at, say, continents like Africa, where testing was limited, and we found that there was only one reference laboratory that could do the work. We have now upped the numbers of laboratories considerably in Africa. So a lot of our work has been done with the countries with fewer resources, and I won't say that should they have a huge outbreak like we're seeing in Europe, I won't say that they've got everything they need, but they were possibly better prepared because they were identified early on as the countries that were in need of most help. It's an irony, not a good irony, not a happy irony, but it's in fact so. While we do not want to see this outbreak raging through Africa, many of those countries have indeed already got prepossessioned physical, personal protective equipment and testing in place.
Yes, but in many cases, the living circumstances are such that people are cooped up in very close quarters. They don't have the capacity, for instance, to isolate.
You're quite right. And again, we do not want to see these outbreaks going through, not just the fact that it will be very difficult for them to isolate, but in many countries, there are other illnesses. We're always talking about underlying conditions. And when you've got a population that's been ravaged by HIV and by tuberculosis, or where the children are really malnourished, or the adults as well, then you're setting up a situation where this particular virus can really wreak havoc.
And I read one report suggesting that, for instance, Uganda has more cabinet ministers than it has intensive care beds.
I don't have those numbers in front of me, but indeed, again, in many countries, not simply Africa, many countries around the world, intensive care units are not a common sight.
Yes, but just in regard to the testing materials, and you say you were in a position, the WHO, to help to provide support for the poorer countries. Does that mean that you have a kind of a central pool of those resources that you can distribute where needed?
That is one of our big jobs, actually. So we have a logistics unit. We don't have a pool, like we don't have a specific warehouse, but we work with partners who do. So, for instance, the World Food Programme are the sort of the greatest logistical people for the UN system, and they've got massive warehouses, and they're working incredibly hard to try to move supplies all around the world. Testing kits, reagents, personal protective equipment, all those things are being gathered and transported wherever they're needed.
Yeah, I wonder though, is it fair that countries essentially they're in competition with each other? We're here in Ireland. We have faced difficulties competing in the global market for testing and for PPE, for personal protective equipment.
So, yes, and these things have really become evident by this outbreak. Now, in previous outbreaks like the flu and other sort of infectious diseases, we learned early on that we need to stockpile vaccines so that countries in need of them can get them. So now we're seeing a situation where other things need to perhaps be collected centrally so that countries can get access.
Yes, and the other thing is, I suppose there's so much we still don't know about COVID-19, despite the best efforts of academics and scientists. But is there any information coming to light about whether people who recover from it are then immune to catching it again?
Well, this is certainly one of the things that the immunologists and the scientists are tracking. It's one of those things that you need. It's like a living experiment. You need to, first of all, do the tests to see what are the levels of those antibodies, but you also have to see what happens when indeed the person who's immune is re-exposed. So that would happen when, again, you had the infection in the population and you saw that a big chunk of the population didn't get sick again. Because this family, the coronavirus family, some of the other members of the family have this ability to reinfect people. It seems that the immunity doesn't last that long, but those are different members of the family. And even though they're genetically similar, their behaviors are quite different. So this is what you would call an ongoing, very important piece of research.
And I suppose really it would be very, very helpful more than if we could establish, for instance, whether some people who have had coronavirus and are would be frontline workers, whether they could safely work on the frontline again.
Well, you would still always insist that they have all the personal protective equipment. So we wouldn't say, oh, that's fine, you can work ahead. So we've seen this, say, with the Ebola survivors now work in the Ebola treatment centers, but we still insist that they're given the personal protection they need, because even though your antibodies are a wonderful defense, you want to make sure that you get all the defense possible when you're in a situation where you can be exposed.
But I suppose until the testing regime reaches the level that governments want, and there's a sufficient amount of the agents and testing equipment, is it likely or should we assume that there are a lot more cases in the community that we simply don't know about yet?
I think that's a reasonable assumption. Also, because remember, this virus, it affects people so differently. A lot of people have a mild illness or just such minor ill symptoms that they don't even feel sick, or they don't know they're sick. And there are lots of people out there who feel a bit off, but they go ahead with their normal activities. They don't consider themselves sick. So it's what you call sort of almost not asymptomatic, but so pre-symptomatic or such minor symptoms, they don't know they are ill. And then there are other people, of course, who get very, very, very severely ill. And this is one of the problems with this virus. It's not a one-size-fits-all sort of virus.
And finally, Dr. Harris, a question raised with us recently by one of our listeners. How was SARS actually eradicated? And could COVID-19 go away in the same way?
Well, SARS essentially went back into the animal kingdom, and there has been rigorous surveillance. And the countries that were really affected by it, China, Hong Kong, Singapore, or Hong Kong's part of China, of course, Singapore, they learned their lessons from SARS and they have maintained their vigilance. And these are lessons that we need to take to heart and ensure that we maintain our vigilance against this particular virus.
Dr. Margaret Harris, member of the World Health Organization's Coronavirus Response Team, thank you very much indeed for joining us.